This is a special report from NPR News, hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of retired federal judge Michael Mukasey to be Attorney General of the United States. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Michael Mukasey is from New York and was for years the chief judge of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District there. He has a personal history with the War on Terror, beginning in 1995 when he presided over the trial of terrorist Omar Abdel Rahman, the blind sheikh, who was convicted of conspiring to blow up New York City landmarks. Mukasey is viewed as a conservative and very talented jurist. In their opening statements, both the Democratic committee chair and the ranking Republican seemed most interested in determining that he is nothing like his predecessor, former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, forced to resign after members of the Senate of both parties objected strenuously to what they saw as political influence in the Justice Department and the Attorney General's less-than-candid testimony before Congress. This is a big interview for a big job, as Chairman Patrick Leahy said. He said the next Attorney General must restore independence and integrity to the office. The former Attorney General, Gonzalez, Leahy said in his opening statement, saw his role as a facilitator for the White House.
The Attorney General cannot interpret our laws to mean whatever the current president, Republican or Democratic, wants them to mean. The Attorney General is supposed to represent all the American people, not just one of them. Regrettably, the former Attorney General enabled this administration to continue policies that are in fundamental conflict with American values and decades of law, sound military practice, international law, and human rights. We see it demonstrated yet again the recent revelation that even after waging and losing a public battle to resist congressional efforts to outlaw torture and honor our obligations, this administration, enabled by the Justice Department, apparently secretly doubled back to redefine torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment to allow the very conduct of torture that this Congress had outlawed. We've seen departures from this country's honorable traditions, practices, and established law in connection with interrogation methods that we condemn when they're used by others. Likewise, we've seen political influence corrupt the Department of Justice when it's departed from its longstanding practices and tradition, practices that historically served to insulate it from partisanship in law enforcement. This lawlessness led to Abu Ghraib, Editha, and Blackwater. And valuing loyalty over competence and accountability led to the bumbling aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, failure to care for wounded veterans of Walter Reed, and the purge among U.S. attorneys. There is much that's gone wrong that this administration has stubbornly refused to admit or correct. To reclaim our moral leadership, we need to acknowledge wrongdoings. These hearings are about a nomination, but the hearings are also about accountability. We do need a new attorney general. We need someone who understands the responsibilities and duties of that office are not to be a validator for the administration.
The ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee is Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, also an outspoken critic of Gonzalez. In his statement, he mentioned the U.S. practice of holding detainees at Guantanamo and other prisons, which Specter says has brought worldwide criticism to this country. Specter also brought up presidential signing statements, White House documents that interpret what the president really means when he signs a law.
And we have seen the signing statements where the president has agreed, when we passed the Patriot Act, to accommodate detailed oversight, and then on a signing statement says, I may not have to do that, may not be willing to do that under my Article II powers. Or on the celebrated rapprochement between President Bush and Senator McCain over interrogation tactics, and carefully negotiated, and then a signing statement. The conventional understanding of constitutional authority is when the Congress enacts legislation, presents it to the president, he signs it, that's the law that he has to faithfully execute under the Constitution. I'm awaiting an attorney general who will tell the president some things he may not like to hear.
Judge Mukasey, in his opening statement, indicated that he would listen to Congress, attempt to repair the relationships with the department within the Department of Justice, and move carefully through the difficulties of squaring citizens' rights with a war on terror, squaring the powers of the president and the powers of Congress. He began by thanking the committee and his family, but he said the hearing was not about him, it was about the Department of Justice. 100,000 people work there in many different divisions, he said, from the U.S. Attorney's offices to federal prisons.
There are, in a sense, many cultures in those different offices and divisions. And there are differences as well between the culture of the department, as it may appear in the building that occupies a square block here in Washington, and as it may appear in each of the 93 United States Attorney's offices around the country. But all those apparently different cultures are united by shared values and standards. Legal decisions and the progress of cases are decided by facts and law, not by interests and motives. So, too, the Justice Department's mission includes advising the other departments and agencies of government, including the President, on what choices they are free to make and what limits they face. Here, too, the governing standard is what the Constitution and the law permit and require. I'm here in the first instance to tell you, but also to tell the men and women of the Department of Justice, that those are the standards that guided the department when I was privileged to serve 35 years ago, and those are the standards I intend to help them uphold if I am confirmed. Because of the times in which we live, it was to be expected, as in fact happened, that many of you would discuss with me weighty and serious issues that sometimes seemed to raise a conflict between liberty and security. A great attorney general, perhaps the greatest to serve in the modern era, Robert Jackson, said that the issue between authority and liberty is not between a right and a wrong. That never presents a dilemma. The dilemma is because the conflict is between two rights, each in its own way important. That's why I have told you during those discussions, and may have occasion to repeat again here today, that protecting civil liberties and people's confidence that those liberties are protected is a part of protecting national security, just as is the gathering of intelligence to defend us from those who believe it is their duty to make war on us. We have to succeed at both. It is the honor and the privilege of the men and women of the Justice Department to help us to do that, and if I am confirmed, it will be my honor and privilege to try to help them help us. As I mentioned a moment ago, you have been generous with your time and your advice in the past couple of weeks. I believe that the Department's relationship with this committee and with Congress is vital to fulfilling its mission. I want to assure you that if confirmed, I will always appreciate and welcome your advice, as I have since my nomination, and that I and others in the department will try to be available to you. In that spirit, I am ready to answer the questions you have for me today. Thank you.
Now, here in the studio with me, we have NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, and NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Nina, let's start with you. Quite a different approach from Judge Mukasey's predecessor.
Well, yes and no. If you look actually at what we just heard, it is in substance really no different from what Attorney General or Attorney General Designate Gonzalez promised at his confirmation hearing, that he would cooperate with Congress, that he was not the president's lawyer anymore, that he was the people's lawyer. Judge Mukasey may have been more literate, perhaps, in his presentation of this point of view, but it's really not any different. The difference really is that Gonzalez had been around for a long time and had done a lot of things that the committee may not have known about in their entirety. Mukasey is operating with a clean sheet, so to speak.
Ron Elving, the questioners started out right away with one of the things that they're very concerned about, the sort of political activity of the White House in the Justice Department. Chairman Leahy gets to ask the first question, of course, and his first question was about the fired U.S. attorneys. Could you give us a little background on that?
It's appropriate that he start there because this is really what did in Alberto Gonzalez in the end. There were many issues, but this was really what stripped away his protections and stripped away the White House's ability to protect him. Going back to the period right after the election, re-election of George Bush in 2004, a lot of the people in the White House, some of the officials there, organized a concerted effort to get the various departments of the executive branch to do more to help the political, if you will, agenda of the president. And one of those things was in the Justice Department, they really wanted to see justice go after voter fraud. Voter fraud was something that has been a huge issue for Republicans for a very long time, and they wanted this to become one of the criteria by which U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, were judged. Were they really making key decisions to go after that particular kind of crime? And there were a number of people they were unhappy with, and for a while they considered asking for all the U.S. attorneys all over the country to resign and get a whole new clean slate for the last couple of years, but then they decided, no, they'd just go after, say, a handful, and when they did, and this boiled up, and when some of these people objected to being forced out, then a lot of this hit the fan.
Does it, Senator Leahy's indicated in his questioning that what the Justice Department wanted was more Bushies among the U.S. attorneys. Is that fair?
Well, it certainly was the term that was used. They wanted people who had better political credentials, people who would be more, if you will, team players, people more interested in the list of crimes to prosecute that interested the White House most for reasons that had to do with political power, with, for example, whether or not certain people were going to remain in office or not, and whether or not they were going to prosecute a certain other kind of corruption that might not have been so good for the president's party.
And, of course, one of the questions that you'll hear raised in the hearing is whether indictments were brought in a political manner right before an election, for example. Thanks very much, Ron and Nina. Coming up, questioning by the Judiciary Committee members. Please stay with us. You're listening to a special report on the confirmation hearings of Judge Michael Mukasey to be the next Attorney General. I'm Linda Wertheimer. When the senators had a chance to ask questions, they continued to lean heavily on the theme, Mukasey, you're no Alberto Gonzalez, insisting that the next Attorney General, if Mukasey is confirmed, must not permit political interference in the Justice Department. Chairman Patrick Leahy of Vermont went first, asking about the decision to hire and fire U.S. attorneys based on their politics or their willingness to carry out political orders from the White House. Mukasey rejected ever using the Justice Department to discredit candidates by bringing criminal charges against them.
It goes to very basic principles that I've articulated before, and I'm going to, if I'm confirmed, I'm going to articulate again in as clear English as I can, and that is that politics, partisan politics, plays no part in either the bringing of charges or the timing of charges, and that people in the department should not be authorized, people below a very small group at the top should not be authorized to take calls or make calls with political figures to talk about cases. And those people ought to have available to them, and will have available to them if I'm confirmed, the telephone numbers of the very few people who can take calls and make calls on the subject of cases or any other subject that may interest some elected official.
And I'd also ask you to look back at the old Red Book, too, and the fact that it said don't bring charges on the eve of elections, that they're apt to affect the outcome one way or the other.
Obviously, the closer you get to an election, when there's a charge that either deals with a candidate or deals with an issue that can affect the outcome, the higher and higher has to be the standard, and the greater and greater has to be the necessity for bringing the charge at the particular time in order to justify it.
The Red Book, correct me if I'm wrong here, Nina, the Red Book was the sort of standard manual of procedure in the old days. It was replaced by the Bush administration with something green.
Well, the Red Book existed actually also during the Bush administration until this became a question at hearings. And Democratic senators were able to hold up the Red Book and say, you violated the rules that have prevailed for decades. Here's the book with the rules. Well, shortly thereafter, a new book appeared, the Green Book.
Ron Elving, could you just talk about what this business of taking calls and making calls that Mr. Mukasey said, what does that mean?
Well, without nominating the previous generations for sainthood, the best practices and best traditions of the Justice Department have been that you don't take calls from elected officials or their staff inquiring about whether or not you're going to prosecute XYZ or any particular person. Because obviously the people in the Justice Department want to control the priorities that their lawyers are following, whether they're talking about U.S. attorneys or assistant U.S. attorneys around the country or all the many lawyers who work for the Justice Department here in Washington.
Thanks, Ron. The other line of questioning from the committee Democrats especially was on torture. Leahy asked about a specific memo issued by the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel. That's the office that rules on the legality of proposed government actions. It was called the Bybee Memo because it was written by an assistant attorney general named Jay Bybee, and it justified the Bush administration's decision to use harsh interrogation techniques. Leahy asked how far the president could go in ordering torture and in protecting the people who did it.
Do you believe that the president has the authority under any circumstances to exercise a so-called commander-in-chief override and immunize acts of torture?
We are parties to a treaty that outlaws torture. Torture is unlawful under the laws of this country. The president has said that in an executive order, but beyond all of those legal restrictions. We don't torture not simply because it's against this or that law or against this or that treaty. It is not what this country is about. It is not what this country stands for. It's antithetical to everything this country stands for. Soldiers of this country liberated concentration camps toward the end of World War II and at the end of World War II and photographed what they saw there as a record of what the barbarism that we oppose. We didn't do that so that we could then duplicate it ourselves. The Bybee memo, to paraphrase a French diplomat, was worse than a sin. It was a mistake. It was unnecessary. I've read the memo and I've read some of what's been written about it. It purported to justify measures based on broad grants of authority that were unnecessary. The analysis in that memo was found to be defective, and the memo was withdrawn in favor of a later memo that narrowed substantially the basis for authorizing measures beyond, perhaps different from, those that may be contained in the Army Field Manual.
Would you... Would it be a safe characterization of what you've just said, that you repudiate this memo as not only being contrary to law, but also contrary to the values America stands for?
I do.
Okay. And is there such a thing as a commander-in-chief override that would allow the immunization of acts of torture that violate the law?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Leahy wanted Mukasey to be very specific. He noted that Congress had passed additional legislation against torture, legislation which had been negotiated with the White House, and that the Justice Department had drafted another memo that appeared to redefine torture, making extreme interrogation techniques still acceptable. Would he change that? On that one, Mukasey appeared cautious and not definitive, as he did several times during the hearing. He said he had not been briefed on the details of secret programs and therefore was reluctant to speak about them.
I have not been read in on, I think is the Washington expression, any classified program or information, including the classified information that relates to interrogation methods or the memoranda that relate to interrogation methods. And so I can't, as I say, that there's something that's out of line with the law in those programs until I see the programs and see the memos and see whether they are in alignment or not.
Will you not only read the memos, but make sure that they are in line with the testimony you've already given and your own views of what is allowed under our law?
I certainly will.
The senior Republican on the committee, Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, again trying to make clear that the committee wants a principled attorney general who will act on the law rather than make political calls dictated by the White House, Senator Specter asked this question.
Going right to the heart of the matter, are you prepared to resign if the president were to violate your advice and your view violate the Constitution of the United States on an important matter as Attorney General Elliot Richardson did in the Saturday Night Massacre?
As you and I discussed, if the president proposed to undertake a course of conduct that was in violation of the Constitution, that would present me with a difficult but not a complex problem. I would have two choices. I could either try to talk him out of it or leave. Those are the choices.
Well, if the alternative is to leave, if you can't talk him out of it, then I think the answer to my question is yes.
It is.
Okay.
Mukasey reiterated more than once that he would say no to the president if he thought what the president wanted to do violated the law or the Constitution. But members of the Senate Judiciary Committee continued to stress that concern. Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, raised another problem with the Justice Department. The department, he said, specifically the FBI, had rebuffed his requests for information and had not permitted the kind of congressional oversight he thought was appropriate on national security letters. Those are demands for information like business records that do not require a court order. Grassley wanted the nominee to do something.
I guess it's like saying, Mr. Mukasey, can you tear down that wall? But anyway, waiting over 7 months for unclassified emails to such an important oversight matter is unacceptable. I'm concerned that both the FBI and the Justice Department clearance hinders the oversight process and may be just another tactic to slow down congressional oversight. So, Judge, will you commit to ensuring that my document requests to both the department and subordinate DOJ agencies, including the FBI, are fulfilled in a timely manner and do not language in the clearance process or aren't going to be stonewalled?
I'm going to assure that there isn't going to be any stonewalling. I ought to point out, though, that in particular as to the NSL issue, there are ongoing investigations there. There's been an investigation by OIG, but there's more investigating going on, as I understand it. And that may be part of the reason why it's not quite as easy as it may seem to clear matters, because that investigation has to be pursued. But I will certainly look into what the requests are and whether the information can be provided in some convenient form that doesn't in some way step on the ongoing investigation.
Another issue that concerns senators is warrantless wiretaps. The federal government's extensive program of listening in on conversations without applying for warrants, even the secret warrants permitted by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. Over the months since 9/11, every story reported on warrantless eavesdropping seems to show that the program was much bigger than originally thought. The White House has considered the wiretaps justified by the war on terror and legal because of the president's extensive powers as commander-in-chief. This was the focus of questions from Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin.
Do you believe that the president has the constitutional power to authorize violations of the criminal law when acting as commander-in-chief?
The reason for my expression of agnosticism, and I thought it concerned the terror surveillance program, was that I am not familiar with that program. I can't possibly be familiar with that program. And for me to make a categorical statement with regard to that program one way or the other, I think would be enormously irresponsible.
Senator Feingold pressed on and asked about a famous prescription of Justice Robert Jackson about the relative power of the president and the Congress. Mukasey said he felt that in the case of domestic surveillance, the president's power might well be at its lowest point because of a specific law that limits it. But, he added, when it comes to intelligence gathering, things might not be so clear.
I think it's important to recognize that the Fourth Amendment bars unreasonable searches. It then goes on to speak of when a warrant is required and when it's not. But there's very scant, if any, case law on the question of whether intelligence gathering, as distinct from gathering of evidence for criminal cases, is something that may very well be much more flexible than matters relating to the gathering of evidence.
NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving are here with me in the studio. Nina, at times, Judge Mukasey seemed to be quite forthright, answering questions in a sort of positive and detailed way. But at other times, he seemed less so. In fact, one of the senators said that he had punted one of the questions that he asked because he said he didn't know enough about classified programs, that sort of thing. What was your view of it?
Well, I think you can divide his testimony into two segments. One is the stuff that he knows and everybody knows, whether, when, and if politics can ever be a consideration in bringing cases, in hiring and firing of career personnel, and the answer was no and no, and he was unequivocal about that. The other half was about the national security programs that, as you heard him say, he hadn't been read into. Now, presumably, the Senate committee could have demanded that he be read into them before these hearings, and the committee didn't do that. He didn't insist on it. And he had an easy dodge that way. But he's going to be back in front of this committee in a few months, and that won't be the kind of answer he can give them.
Why would he be back? I mean, any particular thing, or just because it's their normal oversight?
It's their normal oversight, and Senator Leahy, the chairman, said he was going to have hearings in early January, and I'm sure he will.
Ron, is it an unusual thing for nominees to approach their confirmation hearings without being fully briefed? I mean, is that a sort of a political act, or what is it?
Unusual for people who are coming to an executive job in general to be so unfamiliar with what it is they're going to be administering programmatically. But not unusual for someone in this unique position that Nina's just described. He is being brought in to take over some programs that are highly controversial in and of themselves and are classified. Therefore, until he has the job, very difficult for the administration to legally share everything about those programs with him. He's not in a position to be cleared to do it. So now he will be, when we all assume he will be confirmed, it'll be approved by the committee and approved by the Senate floor. When he does get into the job, he's going to get an overnight education. he's going to be fully read in, and I suspect if the man has the caliber that he's being represented to have, he will be fully read in and perhaps even a little surprised by much he is about to learn, conceivably even appalled by some of what he's about to learn. And as Nina says, the next time he comes before this committee, it's going to be a different story.
And you remember that John Ashcroft complained bitterly. We learned from notes from
the next but one attorney general.
The next but one attorney general complained bitterly that he hadn't been read in to all the things he thought he needed to know when he was attorney general. So one of the first tasks for this guy, I assume, will be to make sure he's read into everything he's supposed to be read into, or
to
that
be
he
sure
thinks
that
he needs to be read into.
No one has any sort of secret policies in the bottom drawer that they haven't told him about yet.
Right.
Did you hear anything from this man that you thought indicated some kind of change of direction, some material difference from what the indicated that he would take the administration down some sort of path they haven't been down?
Well, I didn't. You know, I think that he basically agrees with the administration about presidential power, about the war on terror. His own rulings would indicate that. But I think he has a kind of a very bright line view of the law. And if he thinks the administration is trying to fudge that line, he's got nothing to gain by going along, nothing at all. He's of an age that nobody can do anything for him anymore. He's got a great reputation. He can only lose that reputation, and he made very clear today he has no intention of losing it.
He said he wants to work with Congress, Ron. That would be a change for this department of the administration, wouldn't it?
The administration, in general, has approached Congress as a group of people who need to be told what to do. And for the first 6 years of this presidency, they more or less could be told what to do because they were supporters of the president in the main, and the majorities were Republican. But even then, there was great resentment in the Congress to the way they were treated by executive branch people, by White House officials, and by members of the cabinet, particularly by people like Alberto Gonzalez, who just saw themselves as giving the Congress instructions.
You know, one interesting thing is, assuming that Judge Mukasey is confirmed, he's going to be in a very different situation than previous attorneys general, because John Ashcroft had Alberto Gonzalez in the White House. This guy is going to have Fred Fielding in the White House, and that's a different kind of chemistry. These are people who are much more used to playing the game of politics as we know it, that is, by compromise.
And Fred Fielding, I mean, Fred Fielding goes way, way back with the Republican Party. He's not the president's man in quite the way that Alberto Gonzalez was. And Michael Mukasey appears to indicate he may not be either.
Exactly.
Coming up, we have senators trying to pin Mukasey down on the proper balance between civil liberties and security. Please stay with us. This is a special report on the confirmation hearings of Michael Mukasey to be Attorney General. I'm Linda Wertheimer. As the morning session of these confirmation hearings ended, many of the senators on the committee had drifted away from the hearing room. In the afternoon session, many of them stayed away. But the senators who did not have a chance to speak in the morning did show up to pitch their questions in the afternoon. Mr. Mukasey is a retired federal judge, famous in his home state of New York for terrorism trials, a well-regarded conservative who appears likely to be confirmed by the Senate. The fact that senators generally have a positive view of him, however, that did not stop them from pursuing sensitive questions, many of which were about the Bush administration's efforts to use the president's power as commander-in-chief to expand the power of the executive. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, a Republican, tried for an overview of the tensions between the liberties of American citizens and the need to fight terror.
Is there anything in what I've read here or otherwise that you could illuminate for us your thinking when you balance these issues of security needs of the American people and civil liberties requirements under our Constitution?
I think we need to have a very clear-eyed idea of what it is we're protecting when we talk about protecting civil liberties, as well as to recognize the need to gather intelligence. Rights of free speech are, thank heaven, very much intact in this country. Some people are concerned that intelligence gathering interferes with their rights of privacy. I think it's important for people to understand, as a general matter, what it is the government does in gathering intelligence, not in detail, obviously, but that it is very much like what law enforcement does in gathering, in conducting investigations in the mine run of cases, and that very often we're not talking about anything that is different in kind from what is done in conducting investigations generally.
So it's basically extending in the intelligence gathering operation the same both requirements and protections as we do presently under criminal law investigations.
Correct.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, particularly the Democrats, kept pushing on those kinds of issues. Senator Charles Schumer of New York quizzed the nominee on how he would react if the president proposed a way to fight terror that he, Mukasey, thought was illegal.
Will you have the courage to look squarely in the eyes of the president of the United States and tell him no, if that is your best moral and legal judgment?
Yes.
And even when people are suggesting, as apparently David Addington has before, that, quote, blood will be on your hands?
Yes.
In the future, if your office of legal counsel is unable to find a legal basis for a counterterrorism program, you agree with the conclusion, and the White House insists on proceeding with it nonetheless. We've had this instance, as you know. What will you do?
So silly.
That presents what I guess I can describe as a difficult but not a complex problem. I will either talk them out of it or I will push away from the table and leave.
It wasn't all talk about national security or standing up to the president. Let me just insert here that David Addington, who was referred to by Judge Mukasey, by Mr. Schumer in the question to Judge Mukasey, is Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. Texas Senator John Cornyn, who is a Republican, asked whether in these dangerous times it makes sense for Congress to pass a law giving reporters some kind of shield, presumably so they cannot be compelled to testify about their sources or face jail. Cornyn said he voted for the bill in committee, but that he had reservations about it. He asked Mukasey.
The shield law that's been proposed has a provision that provides a qualified privilege to covered persons. What I expressed a concern about, and Senator Durbin and Senator Feinstein also voiced some concerns, I'll let them speak for themselves, but my concern is that the definition is so broad that would it cover virtually anyone who decides to publish information. For example, consider a young jihad enthusiast who uses the Internet to spread Osama bin Laden's message. The blogger posts an English translation of a scholarly treatise advocating violent jihad and lists hundreds of links to secret websites where his readers can obtain the latest insurgent videos from Iraq. As you may know, Judge, this is not a hypothetical situation. This is a case of a 21-year-old American who writes his blog from his parents' home in North Carolina. The New York Times reported this story on Monday in an article entitled "An Internet Jihad Aims at U.S. Viewers." My concern is that if we pass a Reporter's Shields law, which I voted for out of the committee, but with the caveat that I'm concerned about the breadth of that definition, providing a qualified privilege to anyone who holds themselves out as a journalist, do you have concerns about the breadth of that definition as well, and how it would actually impact your ability to do your job?
That's one, but only one of my concerns.
Would you care to share with us your other concerns?
Sure. Even if you narrow the definition to include people who are reporters for a living, I can recall when I was a college journalist of sorts, meeting a TASS reporter, a reporter for the then Soviet news agency TASS, and it was very clear at the time that many or most TASS reporters were in fact KGB agents who were working full-time as reporters, but indeed were doing a lot of other things. I can't help but believe that the same is true of many reporters for Xinhua. I don't know that for a fact. It's just a belief based on my own experience, and that it would not be above the capability of someone involved in a terrorist organization to become a journalist or to have a whole superstructure erected around her or him that allowed them to present themselves as a journalist, somebody earning a full-time living as a journalist, and still be someone who would be protected by the law. So that's one concern. Another concern has to do with the kind of proof that has to be presented in order to overcome the Shield Law, proof of danger to the country, which sometimes is an imponderable, hard to prove in advance. The example of that list of unindicted co-conspirators is only one example, but it's a good one. Nobody could have proved in advance that turning that over was going to be dangerous, but you can prove it in retrospect. And I don't want to have to look at retrospect, so I'm uneasy about that, too.
Judge Mukasey was also asked about immigration, which is one of the most contentious issues in the country, including in the current presidential campaign. The Congress rejected President Bush's attempts to pass a new law dealing with immigration, and Republicans were the most opposed. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama asked for Mukasey's views, and here's what he said.
This is, as has been said many times, a nation of immigrants. Franklin Roosevelt once sent a letter to the DAR, began with the salutation, "My fellow immigrants." My father was an immigrant to this country. This country has been made great through the contribution of immigrants. In fact, the immigration problem that we have, our border problem, is an aspect of how successful we've been. Other countries have border problems. We have border problems. Generally, theirs involve people trying to get out. Ours involve people trying to get in. We need to control that. We need to control it for a wide variety of reasons, including maintaining our national security. And we can't have a system in which the only sanction that results from an attempt to come into this country illegally is that you get to try it again. That's the kind of catch-and-release program that we've had, and it's brought us trouble. When we met, you described to me a program an initiative that was being carried out, I think, in Del Rio, is it? That had been successful in the bringing of some misdemeanor prosecutions against people who are unlawful entrants. And I think that's something we need to try to look at and follow up if we have the resources. I recognize this is a question of allocation of resources, and I'm not talking about filling up the jails with people who are crossing the border if we can't do that. But I think we need to try to investigate the possibility of bringing to bear some sanctions so that the only result of coming in illegally is not that you get to try it again. Because otherwise we're just going to buy ourselves more and more of what we've had, which is not satisfactory.
We're going to return again to the questions of torture and presidential power Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, a Democrat, raised some of the matters that he had discussed earlier in a private meeting with Judge Mukasey.
One of the things which we talked a lot about was this issue of torture. And you said at one point, quote, there's a whole lot between pretty please and torture, and that you suggested that coercive techniques short of torture are effective. I would like to ask you, so that it's clear in my mind, will you now acknowledge that it is illegal and inconsistent with our values as a nation to subject detainees to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment?
It is unlawful to subject detainees to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. There's no doubt, and I don't think that's inconsistent with what I said.
Then we talked about the McCain statute, which I co-sponsored and had over 90 to 9 votes in the Senate. And I asked you about whether the McCain statute on torture would be controlling in certain circumstances. And you said at one point there could be a point where the president's constitutional authority would override a statute. I would like some clarification on that, if you would, please.
Okay. I don't recall the context in which I said that the president's authority could override a statute. I would be very surprised if that context were the McCain statute. There is some authority that the president has that is inherent in the president, and that he has willy-nilly. There have been statutes that Congress has passed that every president since the time they were passed has taken the view are unconstitutional in that they encroach on the president's power, the president's authority. The most notable among them, at least to me, the one that comes to mind is the War Powers Resolution. We all know that it's there. We all know that every president since the time it was passed has taken the view that it is unconstitutional and will not be obeyed. Mercifully, we have never come to a test of that. And I hope we will never come to a test of that. What's happened is that each branch has understood that push can't come to shove on certain issues, that we have to try to work it out in the way people work things out in a democratic society, such that not everybody gets everything they want, and sometimes both sides walk away saying, could have beat him. But we don't have to find out who could have beaten whom.
For the record, do you believe the McCain torture amendment or statute is an unconstitutional infringement on the power of the president?
I do not.
Here in the studio to talk about what all this means and what's likely to happen are NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, and NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg. Ron, Nina, this is likely to end in a substantial vote to confirm Mr. Mukasey, or else I've never sat in watched a congressional hearing in my life before.
Well, you know, let's be real here. The Democrats have enjoyed more than 6 months of in a paroxysm of fury as they found out one more awful thing than the next that had been going on in the Gonzales Justice Department. And they got most of the Republicans, even on this committee, to call for Gonzales's resignation for months. And finally, they got the resignation. Then they succeeded in preventing certain people from getting the job they didn't want, whom they opposed. And they got somebody whose name had actually initially been proposed by Senator Schumer.
A Democrat.
A big-time Democrat.
The main antagonist of Alberto Gonzales, you could say.
Yes. And so here they've got him. He's a guy with a very good reputation. They didn't expect a liberal. They wanted somebody who would have integrity, who would not run a partisan department, and whom they felt was giving them a fair shake. And they think they have at least a fair likelihood of getting that.
Rod, one of the things that he says he wants to do, and they talked about over and over, was restoring the relationships within the Justice Department, was sort of cleaning up the Justice Department and going back and undoing some of the things that Mr. Gonzales did. he's got, you know, a scant amount of time to do that, a little more than a year.
That's correct. I mean, the administration's only going to be around for 15 months and three more days until January 20th, 2009. But in that amount of time, a great deal more damage could be done to the Justice Department if it remained in free fall as it has been for some time. And that's the main thing I think they're hoping this man can do. He can stop the bleeding. He can send a message that the Justice Department is returning to its best traditions and practices, and that senior people who had served through multiple administrations and risen to positions would not be shunted aside because they weren't loyal Bushies or what have you, and that we're going to return to that kind of a definition of bipartisan, or if you will, even nonpartisan execution of justice. That's the best way to view this on the idealistic side. And I think Nina's also right. This is a pre-vetted candidate, and the Democrats had already decided that this was a guy they could live with. They're looking for another Elliot Richardson. We heard that name raised earlier, invoked, as it were, the sainthood of Elliot Richardson, the Republican who resigned back in the midst of the Watergate horrors and the Nixon administration. That's what the Democrats are hoping for.
They're unlikely to get Elliot Richardson, but they're going to get him. They hope they get just a more conservative version. The first, I think, indicator we're going to have as to what kind of an attorney general this is going to be is who he picks for the top Justice Department slots, and most of them are empty.
There, yeah, there have been wholesale resignations, so there
are
a lot of jobs.
And so now we're
going to
see,
fill.
Are they mainly Bushies, or are they acolytes of the new attorney general? Are they people he's brought in rather than people that the president has brought in? Are they from Texas? Are they from New York, for example, just for starters?
And will it be, in a sense, the beginning of the Giuliani administration? Just to mention parenthetically here that one of the connections Mukasey has, he is not personally tied to George Bush, but he is personally tied to Rudy Giuliani, who is...
They served as prosecutors together in the Southern District of New York.
Very longtime friends, and he even sounds a little like Rudy Giuliani now and then. And obviously, Rudy Giuliani is one of the candidates for president on the Republican side.
Which, of course, raises the question that if Rudy Giuliani were to be the next president, would Mr. Mukasey perhaps be able to extend his tenure?
Yeah, he mainly has to worry about the next 14 months.
Nina, let me just ask you very quickly. Do you have the impression that senators were impressed with Mukasey, that they thought he was a credible witness?
I think they were impressed with him in their private meetings. What we saw today was pretty much ritual, and nobody got their knickers in a twist about anything. This was just sort of putting out, getting stuff on the record, and it'll continue tomorrow. But I think this was just, as I said, ritual.
Thanks very much. NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, our senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. This program was edited by Scott Cameron and produced by Marcus Rosenbaum with help from Katie Adan. The director was Gwen Uten, and our studio engineer was Cal Southworth. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News, Washington.